Welcome to The Deep Dive. We're the place you come to get the real story, the essential insights from a whole bunch of sources, all boiled down for you.
Exactly. We do the digging so you get the core understanding.
And today, we are really getting into it with someone truly exceptional. Allison Janney. An absolute powerhouse, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. Her name just screams versatility, quality. She's built this incredible career, and it wasn't overnight.
No, definitely not. And that's kind of our mission here today. We want to unpack how she did it, you know, piece by piece.
Yeah, map it out. From her start in theater, the grind of those early years.
Right, through the huge impact of The West Wing, obviously.
Massive. And then culminating in that, well, that incredible Oscar win. It's about showing how she constructed this amazing resume, role by role.
And the awards. It's almost hard to keep track.
It really is. The stats are pretty wild. Our source can confirm. One Oscar, okay, one BAFTA, one Golden Globe.
And 7 primetime Emmys.
Seven. Which adds up to, what, 74 career wins and 116 nominations overall. It's just rare, that kind of recognition across film, TV.
Yeah, she just commands attention, whatever the medium. Yeah. I remember this description from Entertainment Weekly years ago. It really stuck. Called her uncommonly beautiful and infinitely expressive.
That captures it well, that presence.
It really does. She has this authority on screen.
She does now, absolutely. But interestingly, that commanding presence, especially her height, was something she actually had to overcome or work around early on.
Oh, okay. So her path wasn't exactly straightforward.
Not at all. It started somewhere completely different, actually. A dream totally unrelated to acting.
Okay, so let's go back. Allison Brooks Janney, born in Boston in 1959, but mostly grew up in Ohio, right? Cincinnati, Dayton.
That's right. And it sounds like the arts were definitely around her from the beginning.
Yeah. How so?
Well, her mother, Macy Brooks Putnam, she was a former actress herself. And her father, Jervis Spencer Janney Jr., he was in real estate, but also a jazz musician.
Ah, okay. So that creative energy was in the house.
Seems like it. You know, a value placed on expression.
And we found this fun little historical detail, too. On that show, Who Do You Think You Are?
Oh, yeah.
She found out she's a direct descendant of Stephen Hopkins, you know, from the Mayflower.
Wow, no kidding. That's some deep history right there.
Isn't it? But, okay, before embodying historical figures or, well, anyone on screen, she had a very different focus.
Right. Figure skating. Competitive figure skating was her first real passion.
Intense stuff. All that discipline.
Totally. But that dream, well, it came to a pretty sudden end.
Yeah, sources mention a freak accident when she was a teenager.
Exactly. That accident, combined with her height, she's 6 feet tall, 1.83 meters.
Which is pretty statuesque, especially back then for skaters, I imagine.
Yeah, it essentially closed the door on competitive skating for her. A classic case of, you know, one door closes.
And another one opens, maybe unexpectedly. And that height detail, you said that was crucial later.
Oh, hugely crucial. It became the sort of paradox in her early acting career. Initially, a real hurdle. Casting directors were like, what do we do with her?
Interesting. But before she hit that wall, there was college.
Yeah.
Kenyon College in Ohio.
Yes, Kenyon. And this is where things start to shift towards acting. She majored in theater, and crucially, she crossed paths with two absolute legends, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward.
Wow. Newman was an alum there, wasn't he?
He was. And he was back on campus directing a play. Janey decided to audition.
And the story of how she got the part is just fantastic.
It really is. It shows her instincts weren't just theatrical. She knew Newman was obsessed with race car driving.
Right.
So in her audition, or maybe it was more like an interview, she didn't just talk acting. She bragged about speeding.
No way.
Yeah. She apparently boasted about shaving 30 minutes off the 130-mile drive to Kenyon. She played to his passion.
That is brilliant. Utterly brilliant. She connected with him on a human level, not just as an aspiring actress.
Exactly. And it worked. He cast her, directed her in that first campus play.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And that connection, it didn't just end there.
No, it was the start of some serious mentorship. Newman and Woodward really encouraged her, saw her potential. They advised her to get proper training.
So where did that lead?
First, to New York. She studied at the Neighborhood Playhouse, which is famous for the Meisner technique.
Okay, very respected.
Very. And then she got a scholarship to study over in London at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art Arday in mid-1984.
Wow. So top-tier training in both the U.S. and the U.K.? That's a heck of a foundation.
Absolutely. Having Newman and Woodward essentially give her that stamp of approval early on must have been huge.
No doubt. But let's circle back to the height thing. You said it was a hurdle. What kind of feedback was she actually getting?
Well, she shared this quote herself, and it's pretty blunt. A casting agent years ago told her that because of her height, the only roles she could realistically play were lesbians and aliens.
Oof. Lesbians and aliens. That's incredibly limiting. Mm.
It's stark, isn't it? It really speaks to how narrow the boxes were, especially for women back in the 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, the typical female lead wasn't usually 6 feet tall.
Right. She wasn't the ingenue type or the conventional wife just based on physicality in their eyes. So she had to really fight for parts that matched her presence. You know, intelligent characters, strong characters, maybe unconventional ones.
So she had to kind of wait for the industry perception to shift or for roles to catch up to what she offered.
Pretty much. She had to turn what they saw as a limitation into her unique strength, her signature. That commanding presence became her trademark, something no one else could replicate.
And that waiting period, it definitely involved a lot of just work. The working actor grind, as they say. This wasn't an overnight success.
Not even close. It was about building slowly, consistently, laying the groundwork.
What did that look like practically?
Well, she started doing off-Broadway stuff around 1989, and significantly, she spent a good chunk of time in daytime TV, soap operas.
The soaps. Which ones?
She did stints on As the World Turns and had a pretty solid 2-year recurring role on Guiding Light. She played Ginger, one of the Spalding family's maids.
You know, people sometimes knock soap operas, but the demands must be intense. All that dialogue, quick turnarounds.
Oh, absolutely. Think about it. Memorizing lines fast, hitting your marks perfectly, turning emotions on a dime. That's incredible training, especially for the kind of fast-paced, dialogue-heavy work she'd do later.
Good point. Like prep for Sorkin, almost.
Exactly. It teaches you efficiency. And alongside that, she was doing the classic New York actor thing, guest spots on procedural shows.
Like Law & Order. Everyone did Law & Order.
Yep. 1994. She played a character named Anne Madsen in an episode called Old Friends. She was a witness, reluctant to testify against the Russian mob. It's like a rite of passage.
Totally. But the real heat, the industry cred, that came from the stage, right?
Definitely. While grinding it out on TV, she was simultaneously building a really strong reputation in the theater world. That's where the buzz started.
Her Broadway debut was in 96.
Yes, in a revival of Noel Coward's Present Laughter. She played Liz Essendine, starring opposite Frank Langella.
And the reviews were good.
More than good. The New York Times specifically highlighted her performance, even in a supporting role. They called it the most fully accomplished performance on the stage.
Wow, that's huge praise.
It was. And it led to awards recognition, the Outer Critics Circle Award, a Drama Desk nomination. People were noticing her ability to elevate everything she was in.
She makes everyone else look better.
Kind of, yeah. A force multiplier. And that momentum carried her straight into another major stage role the very next year, 1997, Arthur Miller's A View from the Bridge.
A classic. A really heavy play. Who did she play?
She played Beatrice Carbone, the wife, a really complex, tragic role, initially opposite Anthony LaPaglia.
He was later replaced by Tony Danza, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Bit of trivia there.
He was. But her performance as Beatrice was the constant, and it earned her a Tony Award nomination for Best Actress in a Play.
A Tony nomination. Plus another Drama Desk Award, this time winning for Outstanding Featured Actress.
Right. So by this point, the theater world absolutely knew who she was. Not just reliable, but a genuine star capable of handling heavy drama, complex language. She was ready.
Okay, so Broadway conquered. Now, 1999. This seems like a pivotal year, even before The West Wing hit. She popped up in some memorable films.
Yeah, 99 was like a showcase of her range just waiting to explode. 3 really distinct, high-profile supporting roles back to back to back.
What were they?
Okay, you had her as Miss Perky, the kind of offbeat guidance counselor in the teen comedy, 10 Things I Hate About You.
Loved her in that. I know you can be overwhelmed and you can be underwhelmed, but can you ever just be whelmed?
Exactly. Then, totally different, she was Loretta in the very dark satire Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Another great quirky role.
And then the big one that year, American Beauty.
Right. The film that won Best Picture, she played Barbara Fitz, Colonel Fitz's wife. A much more subdued, dramatic part.
Totally. So in 1 year, you see sharp comedy, broad satire, and quiet tragedy. It proved she could slide into any genre, any tone, and be completely believable.
That stage training paying off on screen.
Absolutely. She could hold her own in these major film ensembles. It perfectly positioned her for what came next. She wasn't just a theater actor doing bit parts anymore. She was someone people like Aaron Sorkin were specifically noticing.
And notice her, he did. the timing was just perfect.
Mm.
The West Wing, C.J. Craig, White House press secretary, this role just changed everything, didn't it?
Fundamentally, Aaron Sorkin, the creator, had apparently seen her in the movie Primary Colors.
Ah, another political film.
Right, and he basically called her in specifically to audition for CJ.
Just like that.
Pretty much. It was this ideal meeting of actor and material. CJ Craig was loosely based on D. Myers, who was President Clinton's press secretary.
Okay, so a real-world inspiration.
Yeah, but Janie just made that role entirely her own. She brought this mix of intelligence, warmth, competence, and vulnerability that was just magnetic.
And the character grew so much over the series. She didn't just stay behind the podium.
No way. She starts as press secretary, the public face. But her influence grows, her capabilities are recognized, and eventually she gets promoted to White House Chief of Staff.
Which is huge, the top appointed job in the West Wing.
Exactly. And that journey is why CJ resonates so much. The Atlantic actually ranked her as the best character on the entire show.
Better than President Bartlett. Wow.
Yeah. They said her capability and combination of strength and simple compassion represented the fantasy of the Bartlett White House. She was the ideal public servant in many ways.
And that portrayal led to just an avalanche of awards.
Yeah.
Those four Emmys for CJ. We need to break that down because it's pretty significant how she won them.
It really is. This is the proof of her mastering the character's evolution. So the first two Emmys she won were for supporting actress in a drama series.
Okay, makes sense for the early years focused on the press room.
Right. But as CJ's role expanded, especially when she became chief of staff, the role carried more dramatic weight, more screen time.
So the show and the voters recognized that shift.
They did. Her next two Emmy wins for CJ were in the lead actress in a drama series category.
Winning lead and supporting Emmys for the exact same character on the same show. That has to be incredibly rare.
Almost unheard of. It just shows how brilliantly she navigated that character's arc. And yeah, she ended up being the most awarded actor in that phenomenal cast. Plus four Screen Actors Guild Awards for the role, too.
Just incredible. But beyond the awards, CJ did something else important, didn't she? Something about the Sorkin woman critique.
Ah, yes. The Sorkin woman argument. This was a recurring criticism of Aaron Sorkin's writing, especially early on.
Remind us what that was about.
Critics argued that Sorkin often wrote female characters who were incredibly smart, incredibly competent, but ultimately their stories revolved around their emotional issues or their relationships with the male leads.
Like they were there to challenge the guys or prop them up, maybe seem a bit brittle or overly intellectualized.
Kind of, yeah. Often seeming flustered or defined by romantic entanglements, despite their brilliance. The critique was they sometimes lacked maybe true independent agency or depth beyond their function in the men's stories.
Okay. So how did CJ break that mold?
Well, CJ was just fully realized. Vulture ranked her as the second best Sorkin character ever across all his shows. They called her classy, self-assured, and legitimately funny.
Mm-hmm.
Her promotion to chief of staff, purely based on merit and capability, not tied to a romantic plotline. She had her own complex inner life, her own professional trajectory. She felt complete.
And funny. We can't forget the funny. She was hilarious.
Oh, absolutely. The physical comedy she could pull off within that high-stakes environment was amazing. The prime example has to be the Jackal.
Yes. Lip-syncing in her office, pure gold.
Or even more famously, perhaps, the turkey pardon incident.
Oh, my God. The turkeys. When the first one dies.
Yes. And she has to choose between two live turkeys, deciding which one gets the presidential pardon, all while trying to keep the press corps from realizing anything's wrong.
The controlled chaos. The barely suppressed panic.
Yeah.
It's a masterclass in comedic timing under pressure.
Totally. It shows her range within just that one role. The sharp Sorkin dialogue, the high drama of politics, and then this brilliant physical comedy. She could do it all. CJ Craig cemented her as a truly multifaceted star.
Okay, so The West Wing makes her a household name, an Emmy magnet. What happens next? Does she transition more fully into film?
She definitely leverages that TV success into more substantial film roles, yeah. But interestingly, she didn't necessarily chase leading roles. She seemed drawn to strong supporting parts in really high-quality ensemble films.
Becoming that actor who instantly elevates a cast.
Exactly. You see her working with top directors, top actors. Even during The West Wing, remember, she did The Hours in 2002, playing Sally Lester, Meryl Streep's partner. That's a serious, prestigious film role mid-CJ.
Right. And after West Wing wrapped,
The quality continues. 2007 was a big year again. She played Bren McGuff, the very practical, sharp-tongued stepmom in Juno.
Another iconic role.
Totally. Same year, she's Prudy Pingleton, Penny's very uptight mother, in the musical Hairspray.
Okay, comedy again.
Yep. And then a few years later, 2011, she's Charlotte Phelan, Skeeter's mother, in The Help. Another complex character in a major ensemble drama.
And those ensembles often got recognized collectively, didn't they? With her as a key part.
They did. Hairspray and The Help both won Best Acting Ensemble Awards from the Critics' Choice Movie Awards. The Help also won the big one at the Screen Actors Guild Awards for Ensemble. Her presence adds that layer of critical credibility.
She makes the whole project better.
That seems to be the consensus. But what's really fascinating is, while she's building this impressive on-screen filmography,
yeah,
she's simultaneously building a whole other massive career where we never see her face.
Ah, the voice acting.
Exactly. Her voice work is incredible. And it's kind of ironic, isn't it? Thinking back to her height being an early issue for casting,
mm-hmm.
her voice, that distinctive, authoritative yet warm voice, became this huge asset in a medium where physicality doesn't matter at all.
That's a great point. So what are the big voice roles?
Well, the most famous is probably Peach the Starfish in Pixar's Finding Nemo.
Of course, from 2003. And she came back for Finding Dory too, right? In 2016.
Yep, reprised the role. She was also Gladys Sharp, the sort of villainous HOA president character, in DreamWorks Over the Hedge in 2006.
Okay, another big animated film.
And she did TV animation, too. She had a recurring role for years on the Disney Channel show Phineas and Ferb.
Who was she on that?
Charlene Doofenshmirtz, the ex-wife of the main villain, Dr. Doofenshmirtz.
Right. These are major mainstream voice gigs. Requires a totally different skill set.
Totally different technique.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a fun one for the theme park fans. You know the Star Tours ride at the Disney parks?
Yeah, the adventures continue.
Since 2010, she's been the voice of Ali Sansan, the spokes droid you hear in the queue and during the boarding process.
Oh, no way. I had no idea that was her.
Yep. So millions of people hear Alice and Janie's voice every year without even realizing it.
That's amazing. Okay, so let's recap. Tony nominee on Broadway, 7-time Emmy winner, mostly for drama, major supporting roles in acclaimed films, and Pixar star. Where possibly could she go next?
Well, how about conquering television, comedy, and drama simultaneously?
Okay, now you're just showing off.
Well, she was showing off. The 2010s, this decade, is where Janie just solidified her reputation as being, well, almost uniquely versatile. She took on two incredibly different TV roles at the same time, won Emmys for both, and proved she could master any format.
Okay, let's start with the comedy. Mom, the CBS sitcom with Anna Faris, ran for 8 seasons, right? Until 2021.
That's the one. She played Bonnie Plunkett, a recovering addict, very cynical, often self-centered, but also trying to rebuild her life and relationship with her daughter.
A multi-cam sitcom. That's a very different rhythm, a different style of performance than The West Wing.
Completely different. Live studio audience, big punchlines, physical comedy, but also needing to ground it in real emotion, dealing with heavy themes like addiction. It demands sharp timing and the ability to switch tones instantly.
And there's a really powerful personal reason she took that role, wasn't there?
There was. Very personal. Janie has spoken openly about how her younger brother, Hal, tragically died by suicide in 2011. He had battled addiction and depression for years.
Oh, wow. That's heartbreaking.
It is. And she said that playing Bonnie, someone actively fighting addiction, someone in recovery, felt like a way to honor Hal's struggle, to, you know, put a human face on recovery and maybe help reduce the stigma.
Using her work for something deeply meaningful.
Exactly. It gave the role an extra layer of purpose for her. And that connection, that commitment, it absolutely shone through. The critics loved her.
And the Emmy voters, too. She won again for Mom.
2 more Emmys. Outstanding supporting actress in a comedy series, back to back in 2014 and 2015. That brought her total up to 6 Emmys at that point.
6. Okay, but you said she was doing comedy and drama simultaneously.
Yes, and this is where it gets statistically wild. While she's nailing the broad comedy beats on Mom every week, she's guest starring on the incredibly serious, critically acclaimed Showtime drama, Masters of Sex.
Oh, right. The show about Masters and Johnson. Who did she play on that?
She played Margaret Scully, a character completely 180 degrees from Bonnie Plunkett. Margaret was this deeply repressed 1950s housewife married to a closeted gay man played by Beau Bridges, her whole world is slowly, painfully unraveling.
Wow. Talk about different ends of the spectrum. From sitcom addiction recovery to 1950s repressed anguish.
Exactly. Think about the technical skill required. Bonnie is all external, loud, expressive, quick quips. Margaret is all internal, quiet suffering, subtle glances, things left unsaid. Janie was juggling these two completely different performance styles, sometimes probably in the same week.
That's incredible discipline, moving between those worlds.
It really is. Going from the, you know, the precision timing needed for multicam comedy laughs to the nuanced, internalized acting required for a prestige period drama.
And did Masters of Sex also lead to awards recognition?
It did. In 2014, the same year, she won her first Emmy for Mom. She also won the Emmy for Outstanding Guest Actress in a Drama Series for playing Margaret Scully.
Wait, she won two Emmys in the same year?
Yeah.
For two different shows in two different genres?
Yep. Comedy Supporting Actress for Mom, Drama Guest Actress for Masters of Sex. That seventh Emmy win is kind of the ultimate proof of her versatility.
Okay, let's listen again. Lead, drama, supporting comedy, guest drama. Has anyone else done that?
It's incredibly rare. It just demonstrates complete mastery across the board, whatever the format, whatever the genre, she delivers at the highest level.
Unbelievable. And she was still fitting in movies during this time, too.
Oh, yeah. Still popping up in key supporting roles. Like, she was hilarious as the wry CIA boss, Elaine Crocker, in the Melissa McCarthy comedy Spy in 2015.
Right.
And then, totally different again, she played the skeptical detective Riley in the thriller The Girl on the Train in 2016. Always keeping us guessing.
Okay. She's dominated television across multiple genres and formats. She's a go-to supporting actor in film. What's left?
The Mount Everest of acting awards, I suppose. The Academy Award. And the role that got her there was truly something else.
Aye, Tanya. 2017. Playing Lavona Golden. Tanya Harding's mother.
Lavona! Oh, man. What a character. Chain-smoking, abusive, perched on a chair with that bird on her shoulder.
Unforgettable.
Yeah.
And terrifying. And somehow, darkly funny.
Exactly. It's such a complex, risky performance. Fearless doesn't even begin to cover it.
And the story behind her getting cast is pretty amazing, too, right? It wasn't just a typical audition.
Not at all. This is really special. The screenwriter, Stephen Rogers, didn't just want Janie for the role. He wrote Lavona Golden specifically for her.
Wow. He pictured her from the start.
Pictured her, and apparently wouldn't take no for an answer. The sources say he took it a step further. He actually refused to sell the screenplay.
No!
Until the producers officially agreed to cast Allison Janney as Lavona. He basically held the entire project hostage until she was locked in.
That is an incredible level of commitment from a writer, betting the whole film on one actor.
It really is. It speaks volumes about what he knew only Janie could bring to it. That specific blend of, like, menace, pitch black humor, and underneath it all, maybe a flicker of twisted maternal feeling. It's a razor's edge of a role.
And she clearly felt the weight of it. She called it one of her most challenging parts.
She did. It required a total transformation.
Yeah.
Physically, vocally. That harsh accent, the posture, the whole demeanor, it was so far removed from her own natural elegance, she just vanished inside Lavona.
Yeah, you completely forget it's Allison Janney. And the critics definitely noticed.
Oh, unanimously.
Yeah.
She was the standout. Michael O'Sullivan at the Washington Post summed it up well. He wrote that Janney steals every scene she's in, playing Lavona, a harridan whose nodding goes beyond tough love. You just couldn't take your eyes off her.
Harridan.
Yeah.
That's a good word for it. And that universal acclaim translated directly into awards, didn't it?
It absolutely did. This wasn't just a nomination here or there. This was a clean sweep. She won basically everything.
The Grand Slam, they call it sometimes.
Pretty much. For Best Supporting Actress, she took home the Academy Award.
The Oscar.
The Oscar. Plus the BAFTA, the Golden Globe, the Screen Actors Guild Award, the Critics' Choice Movie Award, and the Independent Spirit Award. Just domination.
Wow. That settles it then. That sweep confirms her status at the absolute peak. Not just a TV legend, but an undeniable Oscar-winning film star. She reached the summit in both worlds.
And you know, even after reaching that absolute pinnacle with the Oscar, she hasn't slowed down. Not really. What's really interesting now is seeing her kind of circle back.
How so?
Well, her latest big TV project sees her returning to the world of political drama.
Ah, Shades of the West Wing.
Exactly. She's in a Netflix series, The Diplomat, which started in 2024.
Yeah.
And she plays Grace Penn, the vice president of the United States.
Oh, perfect. from press secretary to chief of staff and now VP. It's like CJ kept climbing the ladder.
Right. It's a fantastic full circle moment. And she's getting rave reviews for it, too. Rolling Stone put her performance on their list of the 10 best TV performances of 2024. It just fits her so well, bringing that authority and intelligence to an even higher office.
It feels right. And she's still mixing it up with other genres, too.
Oh, yeah. Always. Recently, she was in the period piece Palm Royale on Apple TV Plus Day, playing a socialite named Evelyn Rollins.
Okay.
And she played Colonel Howell in the big sci-fi movie The Creator back in 2023. Plus, she's got more films lined up, like Another Simple Favor, and Everything's Gonna Be Great coming out soon.
And she hasn't abandoned the stage either, has she?
Nope. Proving her loyalty to her roots, she returned to Broadway in 2017, right around the Tonya buzz, actually. She starred in a revival of John Guare's play, 6 Degrees of Separation.
Playing Wiza Kittredge, another iconic, complex role.
Exactly. It's this constant cycle. Stage, TV, film, voice work, back again, mastering each one.
Beyond the incredible acting career, she's also become quite a powerful voice for certain causes, hasn't she? Often linked back to her personal life.
Very much so, especially around addiction awareness and recovery, stemming from the tragic loss of her brother, Hal.
Right.
She's channeled that grief into really effective advocacy. She was even honored at the White House at a Champions of Change event for her work in advancing addiction prevention, treatment, and recovery. It makes her portrayal of Bonnie and Mom feel even more resonant.
Taking personal pain and using her platform to make a difference, that's admirable.
Absolutely. And she's active in other areas, too. Voter rights is a big one. You often see her reuniting with the old West Wing cast for things like Michelle Obama's When We All Vote initiative.
Using that CJ Craig clout for good.
Pretty much. And she also campaigns publicly for women's rights, LGBTQ rights, mental health awareness, animal rights. She made a pretty significant donation, like $250,000 to Planned Parenthood back in 2017 as well.
She definitely puts her money and her voice where her values are.
Seems that way. And just touching on her personal life philosophy briefly, she's been quite open about her choices. Never married, no children. And she stated she's completely at peace with it. Her focus seems to have been squarely on building this truly remarkable career.
And what a career it is. I mean, just thinking about the journey. Starting out doing soaps and stage work, facing those early challenges about our height.
Yeah, the lesbians and aliens comment.
Right, and turning that potential hurdle into this source of undeniable power on screen, becoming CJ Craig, an icon. Then Bonnie Plunkett, showing incredible comedic and dramatic depth. And finally, Lavona Golden, just terrifyingly brilliant, Oscar-winning work.
It's an incredible trajectory. And I think what her career really teaches us, you know, the big takeaway is about what true expertise looks like in acting. It's not just finding your one thing and doing it well.
Right. It's about range.
It's about deep versatility. The ability to fully embody characters across literally every genre, every medium. She didn't just get nominated in lead drama, supporting comedy, and guest drama on TV. She won Emmys in all four. That's mastery. That's her legacy.
Unparalleled versatility.
Yeah.
That really sums it up. So for everyone listening, we want to leave you with a final thought to chew on.
Okay.
Considering this immense body of work, we've talked about Alice and Janie's many, many characters, from CJ Craig, the ultimate competent chief of staff, to Grace Penn, the current fictional VP, maybe even Peach the starfish from Finding Nemo.
Oh, don't forget Peach.
Never. Which one of these roles, or maybe another one entirely, do you think best captures her essential trademark, the unique ability she has to just command your attention, to elevate everything she's in, no matter how big or small the part?
It's a tough choice. Lots to think about there.
Definitely. Until our next deep dive, keep questioning, keep connecting the dots.
And keep digging for that context.
Yeah.